Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. For this program, we're speaking with Robert Yell about his book, The Language of Disenchantment, Protestant Literalism, and Colonial Discourse in British India, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2013. What is the nature of secularization? How distant are we from the magical world of the past? Perhaps we are not as far as many people would like to think. In this fascinating new book, we witness some of the discursive practices formulating the Christian myth of disenchantment. Robert Yell aims to pull up some of the religious roots of secularism by highlighting the Christian dimensions of colonialism. He achieves this through an examination of colonial British attitudes toward Hinduism and delineates several Protestant projects that assert an ideal monotheism. British colonial discourse in India was integrally tied to religious reform and located false belief in linguistic diversity. Verbal idolatry was specifically addressed through efforts of codification and transliteration. Overall, Yell's work on British critiques of South Asian mythological, ritual, linguistic, and legal traditions offer new insights on modernity, secularization, religious literalism, and colonialism. We also discussed the language of disenchantment in light of Yell's interest in semiotics, which he addressed more explicitly in another new book, The Semiotics of Religion, Signs of the Sacred in History, which was published by Bloomsbury in 2013. In our conversation, we discussed Orientalism, modernity, Hindu mythology, literary versus oral cultures, Max Müller, magical dimensions of ritual, Christian critiques of Jewish law, scripturalism, mantras, and print culture, among many, many other things. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion.
Welcome to New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. This morning, I have the pleasure of speaking with Robert Yell about his great new book, The Language of Disenchantment, Protestant Literalism and Colonial Discourse in British India. Good morning, Robert. Thanks for making some time to talk to us. How are you doing?
I'm well. Good morning, Christian. How are you? And thanks for arranging this.
Oh, yeah. This is a wonderful and deeply researched book. I think a lot of listeners are going to like this because you're really bringing a lot of conversations going on in the study of religion together here in a very comprehensive and very clear way. I think a lot of people, some of these debates that you get into are somewhat complex, and you present them in a very clear and concise way for readers. So it's a great book. Yeah, thank you.
On that score, I can add that I think as I get older and have more experience, my writing style is actually improving. So there is hope for all of us.
That's good to know. Before we kind of get into the details of the book, I think it, especially for your book, since this really is a product of your previous training and research, maybe you could kind of give us a little bit about your background, perhaps how you got interested in the study of religion, maybe some people that were particularly influential in how you approach religion.
Sure, absolutely. Well, my interest in religion, studying religion, goes back to college, where I actually took my degree in philosophy. But that was in part because I wasn't able to do a joint major in religion and philosophy at Harvard College. It was possible, but I couldn't get the philosophy department to approve my thesis topic. But I was already moving away from straight philosophy then because it seemed rather bloodless to me, especially as it was done at Harvard College, which the curriculum focuses there on the analytical tradition. My interest had always been in continental philosophy, especially Nietzsche. And I found myself more engaged with the study of historical religious traditions. So I even went to the extent of taking a semester of Sanskrit back then, and took a number of courses on South Asian religions. So some of the people who were influential then and interesting me in the study of religion were Carol Zaleski, and took a course on Tibetan Buddhism also from David Eckel that I remember very well. And Diane Eck, from whom I had my very first course ever in religion, a very inspirational teacher. So those were some of the culprits, I would say. But then I took a vast detour after college. It didn't seem to me to be practical to go into the graduate study of religion. So I went to law school, and I learned a great deal from that. And some, I can't presume many people know, a few people may, that a portion of my work has been on law and religion for a number of years, for about the last decade, in fact. Some of which actually touches on the South Asian context. So I found myself pulled back into the study of religion for various reasons. And then I enrolled at the University of Chicago Divinity School, and having already studied some South Asian traditions, I chose to begin the study of Sanskrit, and always were a comparativist. Frank Reynolds was my advisor, a scholar of Buddhism with very broad interests, and he always was very generous in encouraging his students to pursue their own paths. So that's what I did. And then for my dissertation, I used semiotic theories, mostly borrowed from Roman Jakobson's studies of poetry, to get at the function of Hindu tantric mantras. And for me, this was an illustration of how there ultimately isn't any contradiction between theoretical and data-driven studies. I found that the theories of the mantra, the manner in which poetry makes mantras effective, successful, even for magical purposes, siddha, coincided with some of the linguistic theories of pragmatics that I'm using, that had also described how poetry contributes to ritual performance. That was my dissertation. It came out a year after I graduated. So I graduated in 2002. The book Explaining Mantras came out in 2003. And I moved on. And one of the issues that I became interested in immediately in the wake of studying the poetry of mantras was what had happened to that poetry. So as I do talk about a bit in the beginning of the Language of Disenchantment book, I pretty quickly stumbled upon these polemics in the British tradition against the use of vain repetitions or various poetic devices in prayer. And over a period of several years, I investigated this, and thank God for these large databases like early English books online and 18th century collections online, was able to reconstruct the theology underlying the Protestant, mainly Puritan critique of repetitions in prayer. So this enabled me to describe a contrast between these traditional Indian, or specifically tantric, formulas and uses of language and what the British were doing. And that allowed me to do comparative religion in a way that was also historically grounded, because instead of myself imposing the comparison between these two different traditions, the comparison had itself already been framed by British in the colonial Indian context. That was one of the points of embarkation for the Language of Disenchantment book. I got very interested, having studied ancient religion, classical religion, in what difference was introduced or represented by modernity, by secular modernity, hence the engagement with Weber's theories, secularization and disenchantment, and my excavation of the very important role that Protestant theological traditions had played in these transformations in culture and religion. So it's an extension of Weber. And the book essentially continues my earlier interest in linguistics and semiotics and symbolism, by describing the secularization and disenchantment from a linguistic perspective. So that's the frame of the book. That's how my general interest in South Asian traditions ended up producing this second book, essentially covering a whole new tradition, moving from Sanskrit tantras to British Protestantism.
This idea of disenchantment, in the first chapter, you kind of lay out how secularism, Christianity, and then also Orientalism are all kind of intertwined. Can you kind of unpack this for listeners? What's the relationship between these, and what are some of kind of the debates about secularization?
Sure. I'll try to briefly to respond to the connection, the question about the connection with Orientalism. Essentially, I was building from Gil Anajar's contention that Orientalism is secularism and secularism is Christianity. And I think this is a very important contention that is also contentious within the field of postcolonial studies, because frankly, and this is the reason why there was space for this book, most of the work on colonial India, the historical work, has been done by historians who may not have happened to have the training in religious studies and for whom engagement with British Protestantism hasn't been traditionally one of the requirements for their study. But the space then for this book really was the great lacuna that was produced by studies of the colonial era that were themselves relentlessly secularist in their own orientation. And I frankly would contend that you can't understand what the British were doing in 19th century India, and you can't understand the very language that they use unless you pick up the intertextual references to both the Bible and to Christian theological tradition. These echoes are certainly there for those who are prepared to recognize it. And the book tries to flesh that out using a number of case studies. What is the connection between secularization and Christianity? You're right. There's a great deal of debate over this, as I lay out in the book. Even though there it's somewhat sketchy, you could write an entire book, of course, about theories of secularization, debates over secularization. Some people have claimed that the idea of a rupture with the past, such as is represented by Weber's thesis of secularization and disenchantment, is simply inaccurate, either because there never was any magic. Magic is a retrospective projection of modern or early modern viewers onto the past. And this thesis goes all the way back, for example, to the 70s, to Hilbert Geertz's anthropological critique of Keith Thomas's thesis in Religion and the Decline of Magic. I'm much more on Thomas's side, as I point out in the book. And then there are those who say that, well, yes, there is magic, but it's never gone away, and so modernity is still enchanted in many respects. And I like this idea a little bit better. First of all, I'm disposed to believe that there is such a thing as magic, because, in fact, what I studied in my first book on mantras was how they worked, or were believed to work, rather, as magical formulas, even in bringing about concrete results in the world by means of manipulating language. Those are some of the points that have been used to, the arguments have been used to challenge the secularization thesis. The way that I look at secularization and disenchantment, however, is not as a so much a real historical event that could be proved or disproved by adducing certain amounts of evidence pro and con. For example, you know, are fewer people declared churchgoers these days? This is the way that sociologists of religion tend to look at the issue. I don't look at it in such terms. I look at secularization and disenchantment as a state of mind. I look at it as a narrative about modernity that has a particular provenance. And here the contention that I make in the book, and I'm following up on it in some of my current work, is that this narrative, this myth theme, is actually Christian. I don't even think it's Judeo-Christian, as Weber thinks. Weber traces it back, as many will know, in the Protestant ethic to ancient Israelite monotheism and the critique of idolatry. But in fact, there are several names in Christianity and Christian theology specifically that feed into this idea of disenchantment. The one that I lay out in the first chapter of the book is this notion of the silence of the oracles, that the Plutarch has a few treatises looking at the decline of the oracles. And in this sense, the idea of disenchantment even precedes Christianity. It goes back into classical paganism. But Eusebius takes up this idea and he says, well, the decline of the oracles was due to Christ's intervention. And there's a whole tradition in Christianity that says that the pagan spirits, the demons, were given from the world, either as a result of the incarnation or more commonly of Christ's death on the cross, which is the central event in Christian history. This is an ancient myth theme, but it was taken up by many Protestants in Britain from the 16th century onward, and I lay out some of these texts because they serve as the immediate background and context for some of the transformations in language that I'm studying. And in fact, this myth theme about the decline of the oracles is interpreted as a transformation from a mysterious, enigmatic form of speech, or also a poetic form of speech, because the oracles were understood also by Plutarch to have been numbered or metered, to a form of speech that is plain, that is represented by the Gospels or St. Paul's preaching of them. So this trope of a transition from enchanted, poetic, enigmatic language to plain language, which emphasizes the content, especially the content of the gospel message, lies as the background for a number of the linguistic developments I study in my book. But I have to point out there are also two other major Christian theological mythemes that inform the idea of disenchantment. One of them is the idea that with the same event, Christ's passion, that the veil of the temple in Jerusalem is rent, that the earth shakes, and also the sky darkens. And some Protestants in the 17th century, I was just reading John Spencer's treatise on prophecy and prodigies the other week, also interpreted this as an event that ended miracles, the miracle to end all miracles, as it were. That removed the veil of God's message, because according to Christian typological interpretations, the Hebrew Bible represented a symbolic form of speech that needed to be decoded, as it were, and for Christians represented in the form of types. It foreshadowed the antitypes or plain message of the gospel. This was another idea that I do get at it a little bit into the language of disenchantment book. The third, and I'll be very brief about this because I'm sure we want to move on, that I'm working on in my current book project, Sovereignty and the Sacred, looks at the idea of the cessation of the charismata, the idea that with the end of the apostolic age, miracles and in general the gifts of grace, speaking in tongues, so prophecy, ceased, or perhaps they ceased after the first few centuries of the Christian era, once Christianity became established as the majority religion of the Roman Empire. Again, like the other two mythemes, this very ancient idea was taken up by Protestants during the Reformation and converted into a notion that miracles and mystery and magic had ceased. So the evidence, the historical evidence, it seems to me, is very plain. And therefore, I can't agree, as I point out in the book, with Talal Asad's contention that the notion of disenchantment is a creation of Romanticism. That places this trope far too late. It goes back to the ancient period. And as I say, it's resuscitated and redeployed in different ways at the start of the Reformation, practically speaking. There are echoes in Romanticism, in part because Romanticism begins to deplore this disenchantment of the world that by the reformers was regarded in triumphalist terms as the conquest by Christianity of paganism and Judaism. So I can't agree with that tension. And you know, this is just an illustration for me of why it's necessary to engage with the corpus of theological texts as an historian of religion, to understand the source of our categories, such as secularization and disenchantment. There's a lot of room left to do that, by the way. I mean, I'm doing it in my current book, and I'm sure there are many other additions that could be made. So I'm in the camp of people who, like Adhijar, although I don't think he's delved into the theological corpus very much, or like Weber, who preceded me in this methodology of engaging with Protestant theology. I'm in the camp of people who think that secularization and disenchantment are specifically Christian, and that we can't, in fact, understand what these ideas are without engaging with the history of Christian thought. That doesn't mean that secularization and disenchantment are real, but the reality that they have is as a state of mind that inhabits and depends upon these narratives and these mythemes, including those that I've outlined, which, as I demonstrate in the Language of Disenchantment book, continue to be more or less explicit even into the 19th century, and one suspects that they linger with us still. So I hope that explains clearly what my position is on these issues.
Yeah, and I think that's starts to set up well what you kind of address in the second chapter, this entitled "A Disease of Language: The Attack on Hindu Myth as Verbal Idolatry." A lot of this seems to be revolving around different understandings or theories of language, both from a colonial and then from a South Asian perspective. You could explain what you mean by linguistic iconoclasm and verbal idolatry, because this is kind of at the heart of this chapter.
Sure. Now, which chapter are you talking about?
The second chapter, where you're talking about Hindu myth.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I thought. I mean, the critique of vain repetitions is addressed in chapter 4, also addresses the form of idolatry.
Sure.
The idea of idolatry runs very deep here. But the version of it, this idea that you mentioned, is the notion that idolatry, the belief in other gods who are being other than the Christian God, are false gods. The explanation of this as a cognitive error that stems from the misinterpretation of language, specifically the falsely inferring from the existence of a name or a word, that the thing behind that name or word actually exists. This is an explanation that Falk precedes Max Müller. It becomes fairly standard in 17th century, what I call the book Christian Comparative Mythology. Even in some of the specific formulations that Max Müller uses in the second half of the 19th century, like the nomina numina formula. In myth, names are interpreted as spirits. The names of gods are taken as certificates of the existence of the spirits to whom they refer. This idea actually, even in that precise formulation of nomina numina, goes back to 17th century thinkers as Gerard Bossius and John Selden. And also there's precedent for it in the Baconian tradition with this general critique of idols of the mind that Bacon has, which is influential in what we think of as the rational enlightenment in England, and is reflected in such authors as John Horne Tooke or certainly Thomas Hobbes prior to that. So Hobbes's explanation of Gentile demonology depends in part on this notion of the belief in false gods depends upon falsely inferring from language. It's a linguistic error, first and foremost. This is part of the ground for the critique of idolatry. It's an explanation for idolatry that's then extended to account for certain phenomena, such as the use of names and myth. And of course, many people who will be familiar with the manner in which Mueller deployed these ideas. He says, for example, that originally in the Vedas, there's no idolatry, that the names for gods like Agni means fire and Varuna means the lord of waters, and that originally these references were understood to be to concrete phenomena, natural phenomena such as fire and water, but that over time they are misinterpreted as referring as being personal names of gods, and that all we need to do is to use good etymology and trace them back to their concrete roots, at which point we understand that that these are simply natural phenomena that are being referred to and used metaphorically to refer to divinity. And if we do this, then we dispel the illusion of mythology. There's another dimension to this as well. Linguistic iconoclasm is complemented by linguistic monotheism or monolatry. The notion that that developed in the Baconian tradition that we should perfect language, not only to remove these cognitive errors that lead us astray, one illustration being the belief in gods who don't really exist, that we need to perfect language by ensuring an adequation between words and things, that words have to be used in a manner that's univocal. One word for one thing. Bentham uses the phrase later within the same tradition, eadem natura, eadem nomenclatura, one nature, one nomenclature. This notion of univocity runs through the Baconian proposals for a perfect, a universal philosophical language or real character from the 17th century. This correlates with the idea that the name of God has to be fixed as well and certified as corresponding to the one true distant God. And as I show in chapter 3 of the book, this idea was also instrumental in informing some colonial projects in India for the transliteration of South Asian languages in Roman script or versions of the Roman alphabet, which was also seen as a way of fixing language such that the reference to things, beginning with the reference to the one true God, would become a one-to-one relationship. So the critique of linguistic iconoclasm or the explanation of idolatry as being due to a misinterpretation of language was complemented also by these ideas of perfecting language that emerge in projects or proposals for a universal language or real character that were carried over from 17th century England into 19th century India. The critique of vain repetitions of poetry and language was also based ultimately in part upon the prohibition against idolatry, against the idea that God, being like a mortal man, could be persuaded by means of rhetorical language and would also reach down into the world to perform certain concrete effects as a result of being so persuaded by petitionary prayer. But that's a little bit different.
Sure. This leads into what you deal with in the third chapter fairly well. You've already talked a little bit about this. Maybe you could kind of give us some details to the colonial responses to this linguistic diversity in South Asia. So you mentioned this transliteration project, but you also in the book go into great detail about this kind of codification, this process that colonial actors were pursuing as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Again, what I'm trying to do in each of these chapters is not to replace the conventional accounts that we have in post-colonial studies of what happened in the colonial era, but simply add a layer of nuance that recognizes the role that, that Protestant theology played. And this is a good example of that, because there's been a lot of discussion already of colonial projects for codification as being somehow control, regimentation of discourse, a la Foucault, and it's received a great deal of attention already. But what I think that, that most of these histories have left out is the role that Protestant ideas of literalism, of the importance of the canon of scripture, of sola scriptura, or scripture alone as the source of salvation, played also even in what we would otherwise think of as secular colonial projects, as administrative projects for the organization of Indian discourses. So in chapter three, I look at some of these theological ideas as they influenced proposals for codification, that is to say, the reduction of Indian languages and literatures to a kind of a fixed canon. That was also a printed canon, by the way. The role of printing in these developments shouldn't be underestimated. And also proposals for a uniform alphabet or way of recording the scripts, which were very important also for missionaries and often had their origins in the desire of missionaries to proselytize among certain groups. So an alphabet was needed, for example, to record the often as yet only oral traditions of these groups in some way, to record them with phonetic accuracy through a system of notation, often based on the Roman alphabet with diacritics, but then also to translate the Bible into this, this kind of script as a means of then disseminating it, especially by print. So I look at the manner in which the missionizing impulse, which also correlated with the idea of sola scriptura, of the importance of the canon of scripture, was important in informing many of these colonial projects. And, you know, not only among missionaries where you would expect to find it, but also among scholars like Max Müller, who actually composed a version of a missionary alphabet. I was very much involved in that. So people may be aware, of course, that many historians of religions are sort of historians of South Asia, of Müller's work, his massive labor to produce a first edited version of the Rig Veda, which took, I don't remember off the top of my head anymore, 24, 20, 25, 28 years, that actually brought him to England to begin with, to work on the manuscripts, where he was then supported ultimately by the East India Company. But they're not as aware of his participation in these kinds of missionary projects and especially proposals for Roman transliteration. Also, this was important for colonial administrators, and there's a volume that came out in the 19th century, actually after the second round of debates that happened in the 1850s. The first happened in the 1830s in conjunction with the earlier wave of Anglicization that included Macaulay's infamous Minute on Indian Education. There's an anthology that organizes many of these primary sources, and by perusing it, and I have extracts in the book, it's very clear that there were also missionary or theological overtones to much of the debate, even though it was nominally about colonial administration. And so you will find references to the manner in which the language is dispersed at Babel through the God's imposition of the diversity of languages and also thereby of scripts and modes of writing, and that the institution now, not by divine fiat, rather by government, of a single alphabet uniform alphabetical standard or mode of notation would be tantamount to reprising the miracle of Pentecost in Acts, where the apostles were enabled to preach the gospel to everyone in the various languages. So this idea of universal language that had even a soteriological significance, which is an idea that informed the 17th century universal language that I mentioned earlier, also has echoes in these mid-19th century colonial Indian debates over the beneficial effect of Roman transliteration. This is an idea that shows the affinity of these projects also with Mueller's effort to establish a kind of uniform intertranslatability among languages. So his example here is the manner in which the Sanskrit term deva for God, you know, parallels the terms for God in classical Western languages like Deus and Theos. So the idea of producing a single linguistic standard, if not actually imposing English outright, which many people, such as Alexander Duff, actually wanted to do, failing that, at least having some kind of common system of notation, became a kind of expression of the hope that with the confirmation of all languages or of all systems of writing, at least to this extent, you could have a confirmation of all religion. And thus monotheism along Christian lines. So there were deep theological roots of many of these projects that I think are revealed by excavating the historical connections between the 17th century projects that were happening in Britain and what happened in India. And I trace some of those interconnecting links in that chapter.
Yeah, and this leads into, some of these broader discussions that you've been kind of hinting at between like literary cultures versus oral cultures fits in well to this idea of Hindu mantras. You approach this in relation to what you call vain repetition, right, from a Protestant literalist perspective. Maybe you could kind of briefly tell us what vain repetition was in this Protestant perspective, and then how mantras kind of fit into this this debate, I guess.
Sure. Vain repetitions, first and foremost, for Protestants, beginning in the 16th century already, were represented by Catholic forms of the Hail Mary, the Ave Maria, the Pater Noster, or Our Father, various forms of repetition of the litany. And this was used as a polemic against these forms of Catholic ritual, but it was based upon the interpretation of a specific gospel verse, Matthew chapter 6, verse 7. And when you pray, do not heap up words as the heathen do, who think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. This was translated for the first time, used to the phrase vain repetitions to translate this verse. Do not use vain repetition in prayer, used in 1560 in an English translation of the Geneva Bible. But it had an earlier history, been used by Thomas Cranmer in his introduction to the Book of Common Prayer as an excuse for stripping out repetition from the English liturgy. And ultimately could be traced back to John Calvin's Latin gloss of this specific gospel verse. While deployed against Catholic forms of repetitive prayer, Protestants understood by this, by vain repetitions, a form of prayer that was rhetoric, magic, and idolatry. So the connection with rhetoric should be fairly self-explanatory. The notion that repetitive prayers and tautologies, and Protestants had some debates over exactly which repetitions were being referred to, were means of influencing or people or ornamenting language. And this as a form of rhetoric directed against God, as a means of influencing him, as Protestants thought it was, especially in forms of petitionary prayer, was tantamount to magic, the attempt to influence the deity to work within the world to produce concrete results, and ultimately as such premised upon an idolatrous understanding of the deity as anthropomorphic, as susceptible to persuasion, as working within the world. And so the condemnation of these forms, which is very much based upon the interpretation of the Second Commandment against idolatry, already in Calvin's interpretation, also correlated with what Weber already pointed to as one of the roots of disenchantment, namely the Puritan insistence that God is distant from the world. He just doesn't work in this way, doesn't reach into the world, and certainly can't be influenced by ritual operations that we conduct. So this the original context was Protestant-Catholic debates, but this critique of vain repetitions is deployed already in the 16th century in South Asia by travelers against indigenous South Asian forms, and including Muslim prayers, but also Hindu prayers. So from some of the earliest accounts we have, like Henry Lord's in the 1630s, we see this already. And it continues for several centuries. And so even into this latter part of the 19th century, Monier Williams, a Sanskritist at Oxford, writes a semi-popular book about Indian religion, where he has a whole chapter on the Indian rosary. And he cites this gospel verse, and he uses it to condemn repetitive forms of prayer in the Indian context. And it wasn't just tantric mantras or mantra japa, but also Vedic recitation, swadhyaya, or other forms, sahasranamas, lists of a thousand or a hundred names of the deity, are condemned. And what underlay this this condemnation was this very different theology of how language works and how it reaches or doesn't reach to the deity. And, you know, in the Hindu tradition that I excavated in my first book, in the Tantras at least, these forms of language are believed to invoke God into images through ritual of prana pratishta, the establishing of breath. So it wasn't that the British Protestants were wrong in thinking that Hindus had this idea that language could have magical influence or could even invoke the deity into form, into embodied form. It wasn't that these criticisms were necessarily inaccurate as a description of what Hindus felt they were doing. Of course, it's what's interesting is the different value that the British placed upon these practices. They condemned them utterly. Reflected not only a difference in linguistic cosmology and as a divinity, but also as I briefly allude to in that chapter four, but also get into in much more detail in not specifically with reference to South Asia in chapter five of another book that came out also last fall, Semiotics of Religion. It also has something to do with print culture. When Cranmer stripped repetitions and poetry out of the English liturgy in the Book of Common Prayer in 1549, this is a moment of convergence with polemics against poetic performative ritual language with the ascension of print culture and the standardization and uniformity that this brings about. So there were various things going on in this critique, but it's a fine illustration of how disenchantment, in this case specifically, critique of certain formulas that were also understood by those who use them in the Indian context to have magical effect, depended upon specific Protestant, even specifically Puritan, conceptions of language and divinity.
This chapter, the framework is nice because you use this again in the last chapter. Kind of the redeployment of earlier polemics. Can you talk a little bit about how these debates about Jewish ritual were then kind of redeployed in the South Asian context in relation to Hindu law?
Sure. Yeah. Yes. The last chapter, and you know, I can say it now. The book's published. I'm sure people have figured this out. The last chapter was pre-published. It doesn't have to do with language per se, or the disenchantment of language, but I put it in this book because it fits very well with the theme of disenchantment of Hindu culture as a result of the imposition of certain Protestant frameworks. In this case, what I'm taking up is the another of the mythemes, the theological mythemes that underlies the notion of disenchantment. That is the notion that the gospel somehow superseded Mosaic law, an idea that goes all the way back to Paul and in Corinthians, but was interpreted early in the Christian era as the theology was systematized to mean that portions of the Mosaic law were abrogated, specifically the ceremonial or ritual portions. And this idea that had all kinds of ramifications for what we call secularization, separation of law from religion, the removal of religion from laws, as I've looked at also in a chapter that I did in another edited volume after secular law, these ideas were influential in the Indian context, where terms like ceremonial law and the notion that law has evolved beyond religion and specifically beyond ritual were deployed in order to strip out many of the ritual dimensions of Hindu law or Dharma Shastra tradition specifically. So the term ceremonial law was translated into certain South Asian languages like Sanskrit and Bengali, even in the second half of the 19th century. These technical theological terms were being translated. They weren't some kind of distant precedent. They were being applied in many instances. And it wasn't only by missionaries, but also in the context of colonial administration, where I think not by coincidence, there was an idea that Indian law needed to modernize, specifically by being divested of its ritual dimensions. And so one index that I gave of this in the book is that in certain reforms in the curriculum in the government Sanskrit college in Calcutta that was superintended by Ishwar Chandra Bidyashagar under the influence of certain of these ideas, much of the standard curriculum in Smriti or Hindu law was stripped out. By some measures, you know, 95%, leaving only certain laws that were regarded as still useful because they had to deal with property, with succession and inheritance and contracts and so forth. That is to say, regular law, not ritual. But in this chapter, I trace the manner in which some of these biases that law, in order to be evolved, has to evolve beyond ritual and coincidentally, but not coincidentally, actually, but in symbiotic fashion, that religion evolves precisely by evolving beyond ritual, by becoming excarnated, spiritual, disembodied, which is something that that Paul already argues in 2 Corinthians, that these ideas were very much at play in the context for some of these colonial administrative reforms. And they were at play also, of course, in the discourse of scholars. So for several centuries, Hindus were compared to Jews on the basis of perceived resemblances in their laws, precisely over the extent to which laws seemed to be imbued with ritual or entangled in entwined with ritual. And there were also historical discussions, debates over whether the Hindus were a lost tribe of the Jews or whether, conversely, they presented something like a pure patriarchal tradition that had influenced Judaism, that influenced Moses. You know, who comes first, Moses or Manu, the lawgiver of the Hindus? Because these resemblances were perceived to be precisely that close. And so it was an important trope, this parallel between Hindus and Jews that was constructed in the scholarship. and one that had certain kinds of consequences also, because the notion that just as Mosaic law had supposedly evolved into gospel tradition, so too should Hindu law ultimately, or Hinduism ultimately, evolve beyond this kind of entwinement, entanglement with ritual by being divested of these carnal dimensions. So this is the aspect of disenchantment or secularization that I address in the fifth chapter, less to do with the linguistic disenchantment or the silence of the oracles, and more to do with this other mytheme, the manner in which the gospel has replaced Mosaic law. But certainly a key manifestation of secularization, which is often thought to consist of the separation of law from religion, and one area in which we can trace the parallel between these theological discourses and colonial administrative reforms.
I think it fits perfectly, and I think it does justice to the overall kind of theme of the book. Now, much of what you deal with in The Language of Disenchantment is closely related to this other publication that just came out, The Semiotics of Religion, which you mentioned here. If you don't mind us departing from that for a moment, maybe you could tell us kind of what made you write this other book, The Semiotics of Religion, and kind of how does this relate to your other projects? It seems to dip into kind of both the earlier work on mantras and some of this work on language.
Yes. The reason why I wrote the book is first of all, because a good friend of mine, Paul Buisak, twisted my arm over dinner a few years ago.
That always helps.
At the IHR Congress in Toronto. I had met him when I was at the University of Toronto for a couple of years in the middle of the last decade on a postdoc, because he's one of the most well-known semioticians, a student of Claude Lévi-Strauss, and he told me he was starting a new book series, and would I please contribute the volume on semiotics of religion? And I thought about it for a while, and as I thought about it, I realized, yeah, this is a great opportunity to synthesize some of my work that I'd done also in a series of articles. Now, there's much in the book that's new. I mean, all of chapters 5 and 6 in that book is new. Some of it, on the other hand, represents an attempt to synthesize and integrate, present in a more polished and uniform way work that I'd done earlier. So, for example, in chapter 2 of that book, Semiotics of Religion, there's a focus on the contribution of poetic forms to ritual performance, the performance of ritual as a mode of rhetoric. And somebody, I just actually finished writing the response to the various comments in a book symposium issue on that book that's coming out in Religion Journal on the first issue of the new year, unless something changes. And one of the commentators referred to it as a new and convincing general theory of magic. For me, it's not exactly new. And I also regard it as, because I've been working on these things for a while, I also regard it as an extension of some of the earlier work that's been done on symbolism of magic by going back to George Fraser and also Edmund Leach. But it is an attempt to systematize and extend these ideas of the manner in which the rhetoric of magic is a convincing form of illusion, precisely by virtue of the manner in which it constructs sign relations. The early chapters of the book, of that book, focus then on describing some of these modes of rhetoric and ideas in what am I called traditional religion. And I'm drawing very much on Indian examples, but also examples from other traditions. It's a broadly comparative work. And later chapters in the book look at the transformation of language and ideas of language and language practices under processes of modernization. Those chapters correlate fairly closely with the book Language of Disenchantment. There are some parallels in what I'm talking about in both works. And in fact, chapter 5, which looks at the impact of print culture on these polemics against repetitive language, against vain repetitions in prayer, could be read as a companion piece to chapter 4 of the Language of Disenchantment book. But the Semiotics of Religion book is broader. It's not focused specifically on South Asia. It has a lot of material that on poetic performance that simply isn't in the Language of Disenchantment book. It's much more anthropological, while also continuing to be historical. But they're both trying to get at the same phenomenon in a sense, which is the disenchantment of language under modernity, especially Protestant modernity. And I've been very much influenced in all of this also by, you know, Webb Keene's fabulous work on the manner in which Protestantism had, with its specific linguistic ideology opposed to modes of performative language, had given birth to a notion of modernity of the modern subject. I tried to follow that through in both of these works.
Robert, if you could, maybe if you could step back from your own work for a moment, what do you see semiotic approaches to the study of religion offering us that that perhaps other approaches haven't done in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. I make that argument more explicitly in Semiotics of Religion, especially at the beginning, although I think it's implicit in the Language of Disenchantment. I think, first of all, semiotics means many different things, but what I found useful is certain theories within the Jacobsonian tradition, especially as developed by one of my teachers at Chicago, Michael Silverstein. I think it offers a very a technique, a methodology for analyzing at a very fine level specific forms of ritual, and particularly ritual language, and then linking these forms up to their functions. So have a critique of certain theories of the contribution made by the distinctive forms of ritual, the notion of ritualization, I take to task in the book, and I won't rehash that now. But I think that some semiotic theories offer a better approach to understanding how ritual does what it does as a mode of rhetoric. Also, as I was alluding to in my last response, I think that secularization can be viewed in its linguistic dimensions. And so a comparative study of semiotic or linguistic ideologies, these are terms that have been used specifically in anthropology and linguistic anthropology, allows us to compare and contrast different traditions with respect to their views on particular phenomena like the contribution of poetry to performance, for example, which was important for both those who used Hindu mantras and those British who condemned them. Both recognized the power of these forms of language. They simply disagreed over the legitimacy of deploying this power. And so suddenly we have a means for comparing these two traditions. And one of the things we've been lacking, frankly, in the study of religion is frameworks for comparison, ways of establishing similarities and differences among different traditions. And I think by focusing on these differences in ideas and practices of language, then we have one means of constructing a valid frame of comparison or typology of traditions in broader terms. It's only one means. I wouldn't say it explains everything, but I think that semiotics is important because a great deal of what we call religion is semiotic, whether we're talking about prayer, which is an effort to communicate with the divinity, whether we're looking at sacrifice, of which we could say ditto, we're looking at the manner in which religious communities are constructed. Naturally, this has to be done by means of language. When we're talking about religion, we're talking about an important dimension of culture. Culture is transmitted primarily by means of language. That doesn't say anything specifically about religion, but it's terribly important because it also indicates that whatever we call religion must also be transmitted in this way. And so if we begin to look at certain forms in not mythology, which has traditionally been a subject for semiotic study, you know, because of Levi-Strauss, but also the manner in which certain devices are deployed in ritual, that we can see how formality, repetition, palindromes, chiasmus, poetic devices serve to reinforce the communicative function of many of the forms that we study. And I think in this sense, it's a very helpful rubric and one that should be taken up by the discipline. I hope that the Semiotics of Religion book and this book as well, Language of Disenchantment, will serve to convince people that this is a very important approach to take for studying not only different religions, but also the history of religion and of secularization.
Yeah, I would agree. If we can use your work as evidence of its effectiveness, I think people would be smart to follow suit. Before I let you go, Robert, though, we've been talking to you for a while. Perhaps you could kind of give us a peek at what you're working on now or what you have coming out in the future.
Sure. I'm working on a book called Sovereignty and the Sacred. I had the luxury of being on a fellowship this year at New York University School of Law at the Tikva Center for Law and Jewish Civilization, and also the Jean Monnet Center as an Emil Noel Fellow. The book is looking at is trying again, both anthropologically and historically. This seems to be my bent. I'm always trying to move between these two different methodologies. Look at which certain manifestations of religion that we otherwise call irrational are actually manifestations of sovereignty, of attempts to go beyond ordinary constraints. And also, historically, the manner in which the prescription of certain forms of religion regarded as irrational, revelation, miracles, and sacrifice, specifically in the deist period, was an attempt to proscribe this idea of sovereignty that was associated with the notion of an absolute, omnipotent God. There's a context, an old historical context for these debates in the Middle Ages and the scholastic arguments between nominalists and realists. And it's the challenge of the nominalist idea of a radically arbitrary sovereign God that some have seen as instrumental in shaping modernity, as a counter response, an attempt to overcome the challenge, the anxiety that is posed by this notion of radical contingency. So I'm thinking of Michael Allen Gillespie's work on the theological origin of modernity, or also earlier Hans Blumenberg and Legitimacy of the Modern Age. I'm looking at a slightly later period, but it's which is more proximate to us and potentially more relevant for understanding modernity, but it's very much based upon these older debates, a moment in which the English deists issued a really vicious polemic against the God of the Hebrew Bible, the God of revelation, miracles, and sacrifice, because they abhorred the idea that religion could be arbitrary in this way. And of course, as many know, the deists championed an idea of natural religion as something that was accessible to human reason, that we could know in the light of our own reason. God wouldn't insist that we do things that we couldn't understand the reason for. The example wrong laws for many deists, such as Matthew Tyndall or Thomas Morgan, were the ceremonial laws of the Hebrew Bible, which Tyndall, for example, says are merely arbitrary and positive. So there's a vicious polemic against this model of sovereignty that is actually directed first and foremost against the God of the Hebrew Bible and against Judaism. And this is the point of embarkation for the book. And I'm working on the early chapter right now in which I look at this, the effects of this polemic also on Max Weber's notion of the routinization of charisma, because as I mentioned earlier in this interview, this idea of the cessation of the charismata, the end of miracles, was an important myth that was taken up by Protestants, especially became a fairly dominant position in 17th century England, and was understood in terms that clearly anticipated Weber's notion of the routinization of charisma. In later chapters of the book, I'm trying to unpack that in the early chapter of the book, also by dealing with Carl Schmitt's critique of Weber, Schmitt's thesis of the exception in law as being tantamount to the miracle, and his contention that the prescription of the sovereignty represented by both the exception, the legal exception, and the miracle can be traced back to radical Protestantism. In later chapters, I'm looking more at the institutions in the Hebrew Bible themselves, with drawing in examples from other traditions for comparative purposes, the manner in which such institutions as sacrifice or the ban can exemplify a mode of radical sovereignty that was prescribed precisely because it's seen as incompatible with the legal normativity and the corollary notion of the autonomous subject that has come to be normative in modernity. So that's kind of a preview of what I'm working on now, and I'm hoping it's all going to come together this year. But I'll stay tuned on that.
Yeah, sounds great. We'll keep an eye out for that. Well, thank you again for making the time to talk to us. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. I hope this is useful for people. And you know, for some people, I hope it entices them to go to one or both of those books that came out. And for others, at least, if you feel like you've heard enough, then you've wasted less of your time and money than you would have if you bought one of those books. But I really hope that the first event is the one that this interview will occasion. So thank you.
That was my conversation with Robert Yell about this wonderful new book, The Language of Disenchantment, Protestant Literalism and Colonial Discourse in British India, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2013. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.